This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The AARP, which is the largest organization of American retirees, has just released a new analysis that warns that by the year 2034, millions of Americans will see cuts in their Social Security benefits unless Congress takes action. The group recommends that Congress extend the life of the Social Security Trust Fund by, quote, slowly reducing benefits now or by increasing the amount of Social Security and Medicare taxes that are collected. But we live in a fabulously wealthy country that spends far more on weapons and war fighting than on public well-being. Social Security is only as strong as our elected representatives decide it should be. My guest, Stephen Hill, has written a book about it. He's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and his book is called Expand Social Security Now: How to Ensure Americans Get the Retirement They Deserve. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Thank you, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's first talk about what the AARP said and what their recommendations are as a way into the topic of your book. Is it accurate that by 2034, there's going to be a problem getting or finding the money to fund Social Security checks?
If absolutely nothing is done between now and then what they'll have to do is reduce benefits by about 20 to 25%. There's different numbers out there claiming different things. So that would not be good. But there's so many different things we can do in order to find that money. And this is not the first time that Social Security has faced this kind of a shortfall. A lot of it has to do with the demographics of our country. You know, certain generations have more people. And so you have more retirees suddenly taking up more of the funds that are in the Social Security Trust Fund. So it's not as big of a crisis as it sounds like. In fact, what it's basically saying is that Social Security's funding is secure for the next two decades. So, I mean, it's glass half empty, glass half full sort of thing. I mean, what other programs can we say where the funding is actually secure for the next two decades? And even the military, they have to come and get their funding every budget, right? And so it's not as big of a crisis as some people make it out to be. A lot of the people that are trying to make it out to be a crisis, they are actually opponents of Social Security, and they are using this as an excuse to want to raise taxes, cut benefits, all sorts of things that is not necessary.
What do you make of the AARP suggestions that Congress start to reduce benefits now or increase the taxes that people pay into their Social Security funds? Those can't be the only two options.
I think it would be a terrible idea to reduce benefits now or in the future. As it is right now, Social Security only provides for an individual on average about 40% of your final income. And that's simply not enough to live on. And we know that 75% of Americans depend heavily on Social Security, especially minority retirees, women retirees depend heavily on Social Security. So it would hit those demographics more than others. And especially when there's so many other things we can do, as I outline in my book, Expand Social Security Now, about how we can actually get more revenue for Social Security. And the short version of what I propose is that we need to close the tax loopholes and deductions that vastly disproportionately benefit wealthier people in the United States. They are astounding when you stack them all up next to each other and see how much we the taxpayers subsidize wealthier Americans, even more than we do middle-class Americans and working-class Americans.
Right. So there are, of course, plenty of ways to strengthen this program. But I think it's worth taking a small history lesson back to what the original intent was. This was Social Security was a program that was signed into law by FDR as a means for Americans who were struggling to have some safety net after a lifetime of working. So is that the sort of a way that we should look at it? I mean, what was the original intent and how was it even viewed at the time? Was it opposed by, the sort of anti-communists as a socialist conspiracy even at its founding?
Yes. In fact, on August 14th, we just celebrated the 81st birthday of Social Security. So we've had it around for a long time. It's not only about you know, retirees, but Social Security also funds people with disabilities, widows, you know, children who have lost their parents. It's really more about who we are as a country. In many ways, we've lived in the Social Security era ever since the New Deal and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And so it's really about how we define ourselves as a country. And so that's why I think we have to really look hard about how we can shore this up and make it work instead of just sort of throw up our hands and say, oh, well, I guess we've got to cut benefits. I mean, it's certainly true that when it began back in 1935, it was intended to be a supplement for, you know, people who especially weren't doing very well, seniors, retirees who were in poverty. And in fact, it succeeded. Social Security is the greatest anti-poverty program that the United States has. But then when you flash forward into the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, when, you know, our society began changing and we had company pensions and we had more people saving money for retirement, we had more people buying homes that became part of their retirement nest egg. Social Security also became part of what was known as the three-legged stool of retirement. And it no longer was just simply for people who are in poverty. It became part of our national infrastructure. And now you flash forward to the 2010s, when we had an economic collapse in 2008, 2009. And we saw that two out of three of those legs of the retirement stool, namely home ownership and private savings, company pensions, 401ks, they completely collapsed. Social Security has emerged as the most stable of the retirement legs. And so it's something that we should be building upon, because it has shown that it works better than some of these other parts of the retirement system that we've had. And furthermore, Social Security has a lot more support across the board. Even 70% of Republicans say that they support Social Security.
Right.
So these are realities that we should be building upon instead of looking at ways to cut back what has been successful.
And in fact, it has sadly become yet another political football between elected officials, Republicans and Democrats, you know, in terms of undermining this program that our neoliberal economic fundamentalists like to view as a handout. Even this new title for it, a new term for it that has caught on sadly in the media as an entitlement program, as if it's some sort of handout rather than something that we all pay in to those of us who earn money, that also sort of gives a sense of how elected officials and our mainstream media view Social Security. So, Stephen, we're in a very crucial election year this year. What advice would you give to the two remaining presidential candidates, sadly the two most unpopular candidates that we've had in a long time, about how they might be able to win over voters?
Well, I mean, both of these candidates are universally unpopular. This is true. And I think one of them could quickly increase their popularity if they proposed expanding Social Security. You know, Bernie Sanders was calling for that during the primary. Hillary Clinton recently begrudgingly has said, OK, I guess we should expand it, but only for people who need it the most. And her definition of the people who needs it the most means not very many people at all. Donald Trump actually, very interestingly, I mean, despite his, you know, his many crazy views on other things, alone among all the Republican candidates during the primary, he was the only one saying, cut Social Security? No way. We need to maintain it because, you know what, we made a deal with people. We said, if you pay into this fund, into this Social Security trust fund as part of your retirement, it will be there when you retire. We've made a deal with these people. We need to keep that deal. So in many ways, Donald Trump has done more to move the political center on this than Hillary Clinton has done.
Which is just such a sad statement on the state of our politics and on the Democratic Party.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, if Donald Trump were to suddenly say, you know what, let's expand Social Security and leapfrog over Hillary on this issue, and if you'd quit saying a lot of the other crazy stuff, and he's focused more on his economic populist issues, I think you could see this race tighten up very fast.
Right. And the economic populist issues are the most important issue in this election, as Bernie Sanders' campaign and wild popularity proved. The country is hungry for these sorts of ideas, you know, things like making college free and cutting college debt, also expanding Medicare to include everybody, and certainly on the issue of Social Security, as you called it, an anti-poverty program. Far too many Americans have been struggling for far too long. Stephen, let's get into the details of your idea. You mentioned earlier that closing some tax loopholes could help close that gap that would come in a couple of decades on the Social Security Trust Fund. So does that mean that rather than this trust fund being based solely on what people put into it from their paychecks, that would also be funded by the U.S. Treasury and sort of supplemented by the U.S. Treasury from monies that they could get by closing tax loopholes?
Well, what it means is that we're already spending a certain amount of money as the country for subsidizing people in various ways for retirement. And what you, when you start breaking down the numbers, what you discover is that wealthier Americans are receiving a lot more in subsidy than it, than it's commonly known. So when you look at things like how we subsidize individual retirement accounts, the amount that's subsidized is about $165 billion a year. So when you save money, you put it in IRA, 401k, these sorts of things, that's being subsidized. And what we know is that 80% of that subsidy goes to the upper 10 to 15% of wealthier Americans. So most middle class, working class, and especially poorer class Americans are not benefiting from this at all.
So essentially it's welfare for the rich. Let's just make it clear.
If you want to call it, you know, if we can call people on welfare, welfare queens, you can certainly make a case that this is another form of welfare queen. This is welfare for the rich. And it's also, it's not the only example. In fact, Donald Trump, to his credit, again, he's been one of the people that's talked about things like loopholes around what's called carried interest, which allows hedge fund managers to pay a lot less tax than their chauffeurs and their door people and their maids and their secretaries. And so there are all sorts of loopholes and deductions like this built into the tax code that when you break down the numbers, you see that, you know, 80%, 90% of the benefit is going to the upper 10, 15, 20% of wealthier Americans. And so another example is the payroll cap, which Bernie Sanders talked about a lot. The reality is that after $118,500, you don't, if you make more than that, you don't pay any more into the Social Security fund. And what that means is that, you know, you and I, when we pay Social Security, we're paying 6.2% of our salaries into Social Security. And then our employers, if you have an employer, if you're not self-employed, they're matching that 6.2%. If you're self-employed, you have to pay the employer's half. So you're paying 12.4%. Well, for wealthier people, bankers, hedge fund managers, they're paying far less than 1% of their salaries into the Social Security fund. And Medicare, for example, is funded much differently. It actually captures all of that income, even above $118,500, to be taxed for Medicare purposes. It's just Social Security that we have carved out this little exception for, and that's taxed differently than all the other ways that we tax for all the different programs, including the military and others in the United States.
Right. Michael Moore, in his new documentary, Where to Invade Next, pointed out that if U.S. Paychecks had the taxes broken down like the French do, we would see how disproportionately our overall taxes go towards funding our military. And it would be so shocking that Americans would revolt instantly. We do spend so much of our taxes onto wasteful things, but also drive them upwards to people who already have more than they need, while the rest of the 99% of Americans continue to struggle. So you've pointed out a very easy way in which somebody like Hillary Clinton could gain a lot of traction to expand Social Security. Stephen, what is the status, if you will, of the grassroots movement pushing such an issue? It feels like you know, for the under 50s, we don't worry about Social Security till we're maybe 10 years from retirement, if that, that it's sort of relegated in our minds subconsciously as something that is an issue for the elderly, for, you know, for the seniors among us. They're the ones who really have to worry about Social Security. The rest of us can get away with without having to worry about it. Is that a bit of a problem when it comes to political organizing?
Sure. If people don't understand what they have at stake personally, then that's always an issue. There are organizations like Social Security Works, Progressive Change Campaign Committee, PCCC, that are working on this issue, working on trying to educate the public and make the case that we need to expand Social Security now, as my book says. But I think what, you know, even the polls, I mean, the opposition tries to say that seniors are robbing from young people in this issue. And that's just ridiculous. If you could also make the case then that by funding cancer research, since more seniors get cancer research, we're robbing from young people. And yet, you know, young people may eventually get cancer. Young people will eventually retire and will need to have a decent retirement. So this is, you know, if everybody just bunkers down and saying we're going to fund, you know, the things that we only personally benefit from right here and right now, then the right has really won the conversation. That's what having a social society is about, is that we all fund things that we all need in common, and we all try to have a system of Social Security, broadly defined, that helps us in the things that we need. And also the other argument is that if you look at the other countries where their Social Security, their retirement, national retirement system pays about twice what ours does, they also fund more for children and for teenagers. So it's not there's too many examples out there to show us it's not the case of one or the other. If your priorities are right, you can fund things for all these. I mean, the $165 billion we're using to fund IRAs and 401ks, which mostly benefit wealthier people, that's four times more than what the $42 billion that the Department of Housing and Urban Development funds on low-income housing. So we're putting four times more into funding wealthy Americans and their retirement plans than we are into low-income housing for poor people. So, you know, it's just not the case that there's not enough money. The money is there. It's a matter of priorities. And that's what every person, whether they're young, middle-aged, old, that's what they have to understand.
Absolutely. Well, finally, Stephen Hill, you've done a lot of research and writing on Europe and Europe's various programs. How does the U.S. compare to European countries? I think we have this kind of utopian view of how European countries take care of their people. But is there a comparable program like Social Security in European countries? If so, are they able to manage those funds better than we do?
Yes. So if you look at countries like Denmark, Sweden, France, many countries in Europe, they actually are putting more towards retirement. So, you know, the average Danish or Dutch person, they're getting, you know, almost twice as much as what the average American is getting when it comes to retirement. So their replacement wage is more around the 70 to 75% level instead of, as I mentioned earlier, here in the United States, you're going to get about 40% of your final income level from Social Security. And so, you know, it's just simply the case that if you have the right priorities as a society and you really think about how to make an efficient system, that this becomes affordable, because it's not just about retirees and making sure that they aren't living in poverty, which is in and of itself is a valuable thing. But it's also a matter that, you know, if you're a senior and you have that money, you're going to spend that money on the things you need to live. It's not like you're going to be saving that money as a senior.
Right.
And so, you know, that becomes consumer spending, and that helps to drive the economy. So increased Social Security, expanded Social Security, becomes what's known as an automatic stabilizer in your economy. And that's what the countries in Europe have learned, is that it's not just money being wasted on retirees who are living high and mighty. In fact, this is a way of making your broader macro economy more stable. These people spend their money. They become customers for businesses. So it's good for business. It's good for the macro economy. It's good for retirees. It's good for families that now have to worry about their grandparents and their parents and whether whether they have enough to live on and have to help them with their own savings and income. It's just good on many, many different levels. And that's what, you know, Americans have to realize. We're sometimes too pound, penny wise and pound foolish, as it's called in this country, always thinking that somehow, you know, we have to cut instead of realizing sometimes if you spend more, you actually end up better. Spending money used to be called investing. Today it's called deficits and austerity.
Right. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for putting these issues into context. Best of luck to you with your book.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Stephen Hill is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and his latest book is called Expand Social Security Now, How to Ensure Americans Get the Retirement They Deserve. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.